When we talk about greenhouse gases, most people are thinking mainly carbon dioxide. But what are about the other greenhouse gases? Here to tell us about them are Andrew C. Revkin, a reporter for the New York Times. He writes the paper's .earth blog. And Seth Fletcher, senior associate editor of Popular Science. I'm very pleased to welcome them to today's second underreported segment. Hello.
Good to be with you.
Andrew, how do we define what a greenhouse gas is? I keep on wanting to say green gas, and I don't know why, but a greenhouse gas.
I once did a post called, "What if CO2 were pink?"
Uh-huh.
But that's a separate question. Now, the greenhouse gases essentially are transparent to sunlight. They let light into the atmosphere, but they're opaque to heat, at least to some extent. So they're like a window. They let in solar energy. It heats up things down on the Earth, or it heats up the air, ingredients in the air itself. But they block some of that outgoing radiation. This has been known for more than 150 years. They're trace constituents in the atmosphere. You know, 70% or whatever is nitrogen, 20 is oxygen, and there's these tiny little traces of these other gases left, including water vapor, which is the most important one, but that's what they do.
Does naming a chemical a greenhouse gas automatically give it a special status? Does it get monitored more closely?
Well, not really, because the existing treaties and other efforts on global warming only, there's a basket of six. I don't think I could name them right away, but methane, carbon dioxide, and three or four others. And some of these other more exotic ones, some of which have only been discovered recently, are not on the list. They all contribute to some extent, and some are much more powerful than the most plentiful ones at trapping heat, but they're not in the formal basket of greenhouse gases yet.
Now, Seth, Andrew said that water vapor is probably the worst offender. I just thought water was something that was totally benign.
Well, that's true. You know, with the current mix of in our atmosphere of water vapor and CO2 and methane, actually, well, at least before the industrial age, is what makes the planet amenable to human life. You know, that's the only reason it's warm enough for us to live here. But, you know, as the planet warms, it increases the ability of the atmosphere to hold water vapor, which increases warming. So that's, you know, what climate scientists call a feedback loop.
So something that's positive also can turn into something negative.
Right. Well, basically, you know, the atmosphere has had a certain composition for thousands of years, and lately we've started to change that, and that's the concern. Nobody knows exactly how the CO2 cycle, the water vapor cycle, the methane cycle are all going to interact and what that's going to mean for global temperatures in the next 50, 100 thousand years.
So let's talk about methane for a moment, the third most common greenhouse gas. Why are climate change experts so worried about methane?
Well, I think that one reason is, I mean, it's a powerful greenhouse gas, and according to the IPCC, it makes up almost 8% of global anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions. But there are also stores of methane in the Arctic permafrost, for instance. And so this most recent, a couple weeks ago, the results of the International Polar Year study were announced, and that's a big two-year international scientific survey of what's happening in the Arctic, Antarctic, Greenland. And they found that in Siberia, for example, as the permafrost melts, methane that's been stored in that frozen earth for, you know, however many years is now being released. And so that is a natural consequence of warming that actually could exacerbate the warming. And so as we raise the temperature of the planet with CO2, there's a danger that then these natural feedback mechanisms will kick in, and methane stored in the earth currently will go into the atmosphere and make things even worse.
Now, Andrew, you wrote an article a while back about bubbles found in the ice in Antarctica that contained a greenhouse gas.
Yeah, I don't have the name in front of me, but it's got a lot of syllables. And it was a very exotic one. And the funny thing, well, unnerving thing in that case, was the scientists who found it, identified it, isolated it. They couldn't figure out where it came from. It's a very exotic, contains fluoride, I think, and they think it might have been from some defense projects somewhere, but they don't even know where it came from. But these gases are well mixed, as climatologists say. So a little emission here or there mixes globally and can end up in a bubble in Antarctica.
So all of the greenhouse gases we find in the ice cap were created relatively recently? Or did any of them go back before we started polluting the world?
Oh, no, there's carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide to some extent, and some of the others exist naturally as well. But there are classes of them that are purely synthetic. The ones that were also banned as ozone depleters, the chemicals that harm the ozone layer, most of those are also greenhouse gases, and those didn't exist in nature at all. So it's kind of a menu. And I think the important thing to keep in mind here is some of these are seen as low-hanging fruit. In other words, Dow, for example, Dow Corporation quickly started reining in some of these emissions from industrial practices, and they have an outsized benefit if you're trying to cut your overall greenhouse contribution. Processes like making aluminum smelting create some of them. And so, again, you can focus on a specific process, cut that gas, and because some of them are much more powerful than carbon dioxide, the big kind of dominant one, you get a little bit of you get more bang for your emissions reduction buck. Now, in the long haul, though, everyone still points back to carbon dioxide as the true threat here, because it's cumulative, and for the moment, it's an unavoidable emission from burning the fuels that underpin our whole modern society, coal and oil.
And Seth, doesn't carbon dioxide isn't it released when methane breaks down?
I'm actually not sure about that, Andrew.
Yeah, it does, actually. Methane is much more short-lived and gets acted on really quickly in the atmosphere and ends up one of the final products is CO2.
So do we know how much CO2 is created by the breakdown in methane?
I know who to ask. There's a couple of scientists. I have this ridiculous source book, and Inez Fung and Sherry Rowland, there are a few people who would answer that off, but I don't know the answer to that right off the top of my head.
Aren't there various projects to try and capture methane gas and maybe use it as a fuel? How successful have those efforts been so far?
Well, they're pretty successful. Landfills generate a lot of it. The Bush administration, one of the projects it pushed hard on was called Methane to Markets, going to countries like former Eastern European countries and Russia and trying to stanch all the leaks and oil fields and flaring of gases of methane that were, again, kind of an easy win.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, yeah, that's absolutely true. I was looking at some EPA statistics earlier that say that, carbon dioxide emissions have increased by 20% in the last 24 years or so, since 29 now. Methane and nitrous oxide have actually been decreasing by 10% and 2%. Because of capturing methane at landfills, just reducing natural emissions, that are a byproduct of using natural gas and coal, declining cattle populations, all of those things we've actually been somewhat effective in reining in.
Have there been declining cattle populations? Because methane does come from the waste from domesticated animals, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. That comes from an EPA report that I'm reading right here. Whether that is true is probably...
People eat a lot of meat these days.
Yeah. Well, actually, globally, meat production is very much on the increase. As developing countries get richer, they're moving up the protein chain. Mark Bittman did a long piece for us last year on the meat factor in the climate scheme, and it's significant.
And that's why Mark has decided to be a vegetarian until 6 o'clock in the afternoon.
You gotta love him.
Nitrous oxide is the fourth most common greenhouse gas. You mentioned that earlier. It's used in rocket fuel. It's used to enhance car engines. It was used by dentists. I don't know if they're still using it. More recently, it's been used as a recreational drug. What does it do to degrade the environment?
Well, I mean, it does the same thing that every greenhouse gas does. In N2O, when it's in the atmosphere, it lets in light and traps heat. It's a smaller one. I think it's the third or fourth most prevalent, according to the IPCC.
It's the fourth.
forth, yeah. So it's a little under 8%. It's still fairly significant, especially when you compare it to the fluorinated gases, which include all of the multisyllabic, difficult-to-pronounce industrial gases. You know, those together make up 1% of the total pie.
Now, is nitrous oxide created naturally or is this one of the things that we've invented?
It has some, Andy here, it has some natural sources. Another big human source of it is agriculture. Nitrogen-based fertilizers in soils release quite a bit of it, too.
Are dentists still using it as laughing gas? Do you know?
I don't know.
I'm not sure about that, actually.
When I was a kid, I remember that was it was either ether or that. Now, of course, they have those subtle shots that they can give you. What about ozone? We've heard about it being unevenly distributed around the globe, and holes in the ozone layer.
You know, one of the biggest sources of confusion out there in the history of the global warming problem has been ozone. It could be because it's everything. Ozone is this protective layer way up in the atmosphere that keeps out harmful radiation, and there were gases that we produced, synthetic ones, that were eroding it. Those gases, the CFCs and things like that, they were greenhouse gases. Ozone itself is a greenhouse gas, and when ozone's down near the surface, it's a pollutant. It's one of the ingredients that forms smog. So it's an arena that gets ridiculously complicated.
And do we know why it is distributed unevenly around the globe?
Well, that comes from the fact that it's generated regionally. Industrial activity, combustion. So you end up with higher and lower levels. Of course, it's distributed fairly evenly in the stratosphere, except at the poles where you get the big holes. But those aren't really relevant in terms of sort of the pollution problem we think about down near the surface.
My guests are Andrew C. Revkin of the New York Times, who writes the Papers.Earth blog, Seth Fletcher, senior associate editor of Popular Science. I gather there's a new greenhouse gas that was recently discovered, sulfural fluoride. Did we not know it existed before, or didn't know that it was a greenhouse gas?
Well, we didn't know it was a greenhouse gas. This was actually announced last week, and was a study that came out of, it was an international study, but MIT scientists sort of took the lead on announcing it. And the funny thing, well, it's not really that funny, but it replaced methyl bromide, which was another fumigant that was phased out under the Montreal Protocol because of its greenhouse gas characteristics. So they replaced it with another, you know, with sulfural fluoride, and then lo and behold, found out that the thing they replaced it with was indeed a greenhouse gas, 4,800 times more powerful than CO2. But it's tiny. It's 1.5 parts per trillion. You know, and right now I think CO2 emissions or CO2 atmospheric concentrations something like 379 parts per million. So it's much more powerful.
Well, what does that mean? More powerful?
Well, that just the characteristics of the molecule, it can trap 4,800 times more heat per molecule than CO2.
Mm.
It's just something about the nature of the or the molecule itself that I think I would have to have a PhD in chemistry to explain.
Well, the people at Dow Chemical Company who created it to fumigate soil for insects after a harvest, should they have been aware that it might have that kind of impact?
I'm not sure if I can answer that question. You know, I think it belongs to the fluorinated glass. It's a fluorinated gas, and we were aware that fluorinated gases act as greenhouse gases. But I don't think that I'm going to cast any judgment on the, you know,
on what Dow Chemical should have
exactly.
done. Well, I'll make my own decision on that. Are manufactured chemicals more potent and long-lasting than the naturally occurring ones?
Well, one interesting thing there is, I'll just look at CFCs for a second, and again, they relate both to the damage to the ozone layer way up high and to the climate problem because they're greenhouse gases. They were expressly designed and synthesized to be long-lasting. But they were supposed to be neutral. The guy who invented CFCs, named Midgley, who goes down in history as a most remarkable character because he also invented lead, the lead additive in gasoline. And he got big awards for both because at the time they were seen as big improvements. And again, the big thing about CFCs was that they were stable, and the stability is actually what made them more harmful to the ozone layer and more significant as a greenhouse gas, because they actually, once they get up in the atmosphere, they can last even much longer than carbon dioxide.
Are the synthetic ones harder to eliminate?
Well, in a way, no, because, well, in the case of CFCs, industry is very industrious, and they came up with substitutes. And some of the improvements recently under the Montreal Protocol, including phasing out methyl bromide and phasing out some other kinds of sort of CFC-related gases, are estimated now to be the biggest gains for the climate problem of all, bigger than whatever Europe has been able to do under the Kyoto Protocol, that kind of thing. So they're, again, once people get focused on changing, our chemical engineers are pretty good at figuring out stuff. But that's what makes CO2 such a hard one, because again, it's you can't burn a fossil fuel at the moment, despite the whole clean coal mystique out there. At a large scale, capture that gas and put it away somewhere, and you can't sort of find a new way to get energy from coal and oil that doesn't involve liberating CO2 and you know, billions of tons a year. And that's why it's a harder nut.
Well, how much of carbon dioxide is naturally occurring, and how much of it is something we manufacture?
Well, the simplest way to look at that is just to look at the increase in the last 150 years. The atmosphere had basically a stable concentration of this of CO2 for more than 800,000 years, according to studies in ice cores. The gas never exceeded about 280 parts per million, and just in the last 150 years, it's gone up to, actually, it's now 385 parts per million, so that's about a 40% rise from a number that had not been exceeded in 800,000 years, and that tells you something new is happening. Mm-hmm. And they can actually look at there's radioactive, there's slightly different forms of carbon that give you a fingerprint of whether it's the CO2 just came out of a plant or tree and then got cycled into the atmosphere, or if it came out of old coal that's been in the ground for millions of years. So it's very clearly understood that this buildup of CO2 in the last 150 years is our doing.
8 years ago, Andrew, you wrote about sulfur hexafluoride, a greenhouse gas that is used in electronics and for various military purposes. Is that being phased out?
Well, I think that was the same story about the one with an even longer name that they didn't even know where it was coming from. So presumably the one they didn't know the source of hasn't been phased out, unless someone in a lab somewhere said, ooh, I think...
They can always say, well, we need this for military purposes.
Well, there are actually still, under the Montreal Protocol, are special exemptions for some greenhouse gases. CFCs are still used in inhalers for asthmatics. I think that's still the case, because they haven't found a better substitute. So there are still exemptions for some things like that.
Now, many people have suggested that nuclear power would be a way of solving some of this problem, but wouldn't that release a lot of water vapor?
Not in any appreciable way. There have been various analyses of, you have to build a nuclear power plant. It takes a huge amount of cement, and making cement is a big source of carbon dioxide. And that's the same for a hydroelectric dam. In fact, I've seen some studies that say building a dam or building a nuclear power plant puts them about the same level of overall kind of climate impact. They're not free. They don't emit carbon dioxide like a coal-fired power plant, each one would be much more efficient source of energy than a coal-burning power plant, that kind of thing.
Seth, you were at the recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change conference in Copenhagen. Were greenhouse gases a major part of the agenda?
CO2 was a major part of the agenda. I mean, what was interesting to me is that the International Scientific Congress on Climate Change, and it was leading up to the COP15 negotiations this December in Copenhagen, which will probably produce some sort of successor to the Kyoto Treaty. And, carbon is the big concentration. There was some talk of methane and fears about warming, triggering changes in the methane cycle. But I think that the big news there was that the sense that we're coming to some consensus on what sort of targets we need to hit in order to limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial average temperatures.
Two of the major announcements were that the Amazon rainforest may be drying up and that sea levels are rising much higher than expected.
Yes.
But we have been hearing about both of those things for a while. They are going faster than we expected?
Yes. There was a big story in The Guardian, actually, that came out. I didn't attend that particular breakout panel, but the Amazon deforestation seems to be accelerating, and sea level rise are certainly accelerating. I was in that panel. Both polar ice caps in Greenland are melting. Greenland shedding 200 to 300 cubic kilometers of ice each year. Since 1993, sea levels have been rising by about 3 millimeters per year, and that's likely to accelerate. Ocean levels will probably rise by as much as a meter by 2100, which is going to have major impacts on low-lying countries like Bangladesh and island nations like the Maldives.
The Amazon situation is not as caricatured as the Guardian story let out. Wrote about it on the Dot Earth blog. A number of Amazon experts looking at climate impacts foresee the forest having more trouble in coming years, but not reverting completely to something like savanna. Unfortunately, sometimes out of these big events, there's kind of a rush to the more dramatic scenarios when the science is really more subtle, and that actually gives some ammunition to the naysayers out there who want to reject the whole idea.
Like Klaus Fuchs, the president of the Czech Republic, who gets trotted out every time people want to say, well, there really is no climate change.
There's a group of Amazon experts who have done an op-ed that's running in The Guardian sometime in the next day or so rebutting that story.
Now, there is a political component to this, and that's been playing out over the years. This is the first IPCC conference during the Obama administration where members of the conference encouraged by what they've been hearing from the White House so far?
Just one thing to correct. This wasn't actually an IPCC meeting. It was an independent meeting organized by 10 universities.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It was
building on the IPCC report from 2007.
Right. The idea is to update the fourth assessment report, which came out in 2007, and it was organized by the, I think it's the International Association of Research Universities.
But you were there, Seth. Were you hearing positive things about the Obama administration, or do people around the world see things as not going to change all that much?
No, I think that there was a definite change in the tone. I mean, they are a little worried that our midterm targets, our 2020 targets, are not as ambitious as they should be. But there was definitely the Obama administration was a great source of hope, at least in the plenary sessions each day. There was a sense, I think, that we may now know what needs to be done, and we may be able to get the political will to get it done or to get something done. Whether that's enough to save us from really catastrophic consequences is a subject of great debate. Whether we can act quickly enough is another source of great debate. But I think everybody perceives that, the Obama administration is serious and is going to play along. If they do enough, that's another issue entirely.
We have very little time left, but our last segment was on peridotite, a rock that sucks up carbon dioxide. Have either of you heard about it?
Yeah, that's a whole new realm in the question about what to do about global warming, and I've been writing a lot about this on Dot Earth. There's this there's a growing recognition that simply playing with the sources of gases, like just smokestacks and tailpipes, is not going to do it, and that there's a need for ambitious, large-scale research enterprises that can clarify what's possible, either getting CO2 directly out of the air that way or handling it in large quantities and putting it back in the earth. And without that, without a big burst of research and development, you're not going to get there just with rules and regulations. That's the big sea change and something we've been really trying to hammer on in the Times for a while, but through our Energy Challenge series as well.
Well, I'm looking for some peridotite right here under the sidewalks of New York because I think it would make me feel a little bit of relief. My great thanks to the two of you, Andrew C. Revkin, who is with the New York Times and writes the papers.earth blog, and to Seth Fletcher, Senior Associate Editor of Popular Science. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Take care. Thanks.
Thanks for having us.